The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By, a transcribed program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present another in this series of informal and unrehearsed discussions of selected passages from the Bible. And now we take pleasure in introducing our moderator, Professor Judah Golden of the University of Iowa. Professor Golden.
We get together on The Words We Live By, ladies and gentlemen, to try to understand various biblical stories, and especially major questions which these stories themselves raise. The regular members of our panel are Dr. Saul Ginsberg of the Psychiatry Department of Columbia University and Professor Abraham Halkin, Associate Professor of Hebrew at the College of the City of New York. Our guest today is Professor Joseph Kitchen of the Department of Government at Queens College. Today's discussion is once again informal and unrehearsed, and it's to be on the 25th chapter of Genesis, where an interesting conversation between the two brothers, Jacob and Esau, is reported. But first, our announcer, Bill Malcolm, will read a few lines of the passage.
Now Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sowed pottage, and Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me swallow, I pray thee, some of this red, red pottage, for I am faint." And Jacob said, "Sell me first thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die. And what profit shall the birthright do to me?"
Thank you very much, Mr. Malcolm.
Well, this looks like an occasion where we can sit back and let Dr. Ginsberg hold forth for the next half hour.
Actually, this passage from Scripture is most apt in a modern psychological, psychoanalytic sense and contains within it many insights and truths which are most contemporary in their application.
Seems to me it's also applicable in the whole of the social and political life of people.
Well, before we try the social and political life of people, which would seem like a big order, and especially since Dr. Halkin is so ready to give this over to Ginsberg, why do you say that you see such large psychological implications?
Well, actually, this family constellation of the two children and the parents is a common, ordinary family situation in which all of us find ourselves. Two children, one favorite of the mother, one favorite of the father. Two children extraordinarily different in their interests and their goals and their ambitions. Two children competing for the affection of the parents. All these things go on in everyday life in all families.
But the stress in this story, at least, seems to be on the birthright rather than the conflict between sibling brothers as a whole.
Part of the situation which we call in modern psychology sibling rivalry, which simply means a rivalry which inevitably exists between children in all families without any exception whatsoever. And there's nothing pathological about that at all. That is part of the normal development of children in family situations. Part of that is reflected in the prior rights that eldest children have, the birthright. It used to be conceived of as a unique privilege always to be the eldest. More modern psychological insights have discovered that there are certain penalties which also attach to being the eldest.
Now, wait a moment. I think that what you're saying, Dr. Ginsberg, is very, very true, but I'm afraid that we're going to lose sight of Jacob and Esau as we try to discover how this can be applied in modern society. I wonder whether we couldn't first see what is involved in this immediate story. We've got Jacob, we've got Esau. Not just two brothers in general, but two specific people. And they're within a specific framework. What is this birthright in the Bible?
Well, the thing that occurs to me in this connection, Mr. Golden, is that according to the law of the Bible in the book of Deuteronomy, the oldest son is to get twice as large a share as the other brothers. It says in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 25, in discussing the attitude of a father to two sons, one of whom he likes and one he doesn't, "But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the hated, by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the firstfruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his."
That's really grand. I think we don't even have to wait for Deuteronomy, Mr. Halkin. Even in the story itself, it would seem to me that the birthright involves getting a blessing. We see later how the two brothers are so eager for a particular blessing. And I think we can also say, on the basis of the biblical stories, that the birthright gave over to the one who had it, who possessed the birthright, gave over the leadership of the clan. And it's understandable, it would seem to me, that Jacob would be the brother who would be eager for it, especially since he was conscious of the fact that he had been born a minute later. I think it's sometimes easier to be 10 years younger than it is to be a minute younger than your older brother. And I think this in itself is one of the elements in the story here that we must not overlook.
Do you mean the conflict?
The conflict, yes. I think the conflict as it's related to the element of birthright. Dr. Ginsburg.
Well, I think just to take one illustration of the most modern kind of application which we can bring to bear, I think, quite easily on this story. It's well known that mothers are very commonly enamored of the weaker, the poorer child in a family situation, the less adequate child, exactly as Rebecca was enamored of Jacob, who is the weaker. He's the dweller in the tents, the student type. Esau is the hunter, the robust one, and the favorite of the father. And in the biblical story as well, we see how the rivalry between the children and the parents' respective love for one child as against another is also played out in their relationships as against each other, mother and father, man and woman. So that, in a very literal sense, this is a very apt modern psychological yarn. We all know, I'm sure, mothers who are blinded by the fact that they don't recognize, or recognizing the weakness in one child as against another, nevertheless favor the weak child out of all proportion and sometimes to the neglect of other children.
But just a minute, Dr. Ginsburg, are you so sure that Jacob is the weaker child? Isn't it rather simply because Isaac favors Esau that Rebekah favors Jacob, without necessarily concluding that Jacob is the weaker child? What makes you speak of him as the weaker child?
Well, then let me ask you this, Mr. Halkin. If you say that Esau is not physically the stronger of the two boys, how do you picture Jacob to yourself when the Bible calls him one who dwells in tents?
Well, I always feel, I think I've said it on this program before, that I doubt whether the Bible indulges in psychological analysis. And when I meet the phrase, a dweller in tents, my own feeling is that all the Bible wishes to convey to us is that instead of going out to the field to hunt, he sort of messed around the tent, did all sorts of housework. Whether that necessarily means that he was weak is a question which I certainly can't solve.
How about you, Dr. Ginsburg?
Well, I would see no conflict between the explicit description and an interpretation of that description. That's what psychology is doing every day in its everyday job. The fact that I would look on Jacob as the introverted one and Esau as the extroverted one might be extending the psychological usage too far, but I think it's a perfectly proper thing to do. Jacob was the student, the dweller in tents. Esau was the rugged outdoor fellow, the hunter. And we commonly look on them as the representatives of the two types, introvert and extrovert.
Mr. Kitchen.
Is it possible that Jacob was one who was willing to conform to the culture of his time, that they had become a semi-agricultural people, whereas Esau fled from this, was trying to escape into a life that seemed simpler?
Mr. Halkin.
I think that in the setting of the Bible, Isaac, the father of the two children, is represented as a sort of a semi-nomad, where he tries his hand at agriculture, but is still primarily a shepherd. And for this reason, I don't believe that the pursuit which Esau chose for himself was disapproved of by the mother, and certainly not by the father.
You would not get the feeling that the mother objected to the pursuit of Esau?
No, I'm inclined to think, as Dr. Ginsburg suggested, that Rebecca objected simply to the fact that Esau was favored by Isaac, by her husband. And for this reason, she decided to favor her younger, and as you people have been calling him, her weaker son.
Well, you know, I get the feeling from that dweller of tents, as Jacob is called, that that brought him into closer contact with her all the time, and that there would have been a natural tendency, therefore, on her part, to love the child whom she took care of more often.
We wouldn't know which was cause and which effect in that sense. We certainly know that the mama's boy, the favorite of the mother, the fellow hangs around house and is a dweller in tents. Naturally, I realize that there are cultural colorations to this, and we mustn't get too far extended in trying to apply modern psychology. But since it is so apt for the kind of rivalry situation which we see all the time contemporarily, and have always seen for that matter, and especially the way it gets played out in the rivalry between the parents, each of them resenting the fact that the favored child of one is the unfavored, naturally, of the other. I think that is so perfect a psychological illustration that even though it does some injustice to Scripture, it is entirely proper to do that.
Do you detect the tension here between the parents?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I don't know Scripture well enough to quote, but I'm sure there is a specific passage which refers to the resentment of Isaac as far as Rebekah's favoring Jacob is concerned.
Dr. Hawkins?
I think the sequel to the story, the chapter 27, where we're told once again of how Jacob succeeded in actually getting the blessing from Isaac, all the tension that is evident is on the part of Rebekah. It's she who decides to play a trick on Isaac just as soon as she hears that he's about to give the blessing, to bestow the blessing on Esau. And Isaac, true, he is a little disturbed when he finds out that it's Jacob who got the blessing instead of his elder son, Esau. But there's certainly none of the tension which Rebekah displays when she hears what her husband is planning to do.
Dr. Ginsberg.
I'm sure all our listeners can respond to that with illustrations from their own lives, especially if they have children or are children themselves. The kind of trickery employed and the kind of resentment when one finds oneself bested on behalf of the unfavored child is a great source of conflict in homes everywhere. We don't like to recognize always that we have a favored child. We feel somewhat guilty about that. And when it is brought into sharp contrast where we no longer can avoid it because of the favoritism of the other parent for another child, we have no escape. And we are disquieted by it, but we must face it. And I think the fact that Rebekah used trickery was only an indication of what a tremendous emotional investment she had in trying to favor her favorite child, a perfectly natural and understandable impulse.
Would you say that she had made a good selection between the two boys?
Well, I would say every selection of a parent is a good selection since it's such a personal selection.
Well, I'll tell you what was running through my mind. Here are two boys. Of course, we're not their parents, so that a certain amount of objectivity can be allowed to us. And we watch the way they behave in the midst of a very important situation. One of the boys comes home. He wants something to eat. And what is it that he's going to get? Oh, a mess of pottage. We even use that term nowadays quite disparagingly. And for a mess of pottage, he's prepared to sell his birthright. Now, either the birthright is an important thing or it isn't. If it isn't an important thing, there's no point in telling the story. If it is an important thing, then it seems to me, A, one doesn't sell it, or, if you'll forgive me for sounding so pedestrian, B, if one is going to sell it, one ought to sell it for a decent price and not for a mess of pottage.
Yes, I was also struck by the lightheadedness with which Esau offers his birthright and sells it for a mess of pottage. And the only explanation which occurred to me, again on the basis of the story, is that he's dead tired, and as he himself says, he's on the verge of death and sees no profit or advantage in holding on to his birthright.
What should have made him feel that he's at the verge of death?
Well, it's hard to say. If we may resort to tradition, he worked very hard to hunt and didn't succeed that particular day. Or there's a pretty little story that a hero whom he worshipped, a hunter like him, died on that particular day, and this sort of took all the wind out of him.
Dr. Ginsberg.
Actually, that is so apt psychologically as to be embarrassing in a way, because it almost looks as if the person who wrote this passage, the narrator, had modern Freudian insight.
Well, don't be so embarrassed, Dr. Ginsberg. I'm sure this must be part of your profession, isn't it?
It is. We're always accused, naturally, of trying to psychoanalyze dead people and dead stories, but it's very alluring to do, and this is a brilliant example of what I mean.
I wouldn't call Esau dead, strangely enough, nor would I call Jacob dead. If I may borrow some of your own insights in this case, I think they're prototypes of what goes on all the time, and they're very much alive in that sense.
Oh, yes, I would agree to that. After all, I'm a dweller in tents, and I think probably Rebecca made an excellent choice.
You're not implying that I'm the hunter, I hope.
No, I don't know. But at any rate, the fact that in the story itself, Esau is so weak and so willing to sell his birthright so cheaply, we know that people who have been through long periods of weariness, of privation, are apt to be much more resilient, much more flexible, and can be put upon much more easily, exactly as Esau was put upon, presumably, by Jacob in offering his birthright for a mess of pottage. Secondly, the grave disappointment which he had experienced, especially since the disappointment was reflected in his failure to live up to a promise to bring his father back something which he had killed at the hunt for him to eat, the father to eat. Naturally, that kind of disappointment leads to what is an ordinary clinical parlance called depression. People who start out with a goal, especially a goal which is conceived of in terms of rewarding a good parent, and who fail, frequently get depressed. That's a very common clinical condition.
You know, I think the text is very vivid in this particular case as a description of this. We're told how he comes home from the field, and he was faint. Very tired and worn out. And notice the way he speaks, let me swallow. The Hebrew is even stronger than that, by the way. Just pour it down me. There's some of this red, red stuff. He hasn't even got the energy to lift the cup or to lift the bowl in order to drink it. Mr. Halkin.
The contrast is really pathetic between the one who is so dead tired that all he can think of is a sip of something, and the other one who is calm and is ready to strike a bargain when a bargain is available.
It struck me that this position of Esau is also rather pathetic because he did not want to accept evidently the responsibilities that went with the birthright. I'm not versed on the background of this as well as either of you, but I believe that Esau was willing to sell it cheaply because he didn't recognize it as a privilege, as an opportunity, as something that you could do something with. Jacob had that vision. And he was willing to strike a bargain to get it and was evidently willing to pay a pretty fair price. That is, his brother's obvious disapproval in the future.
Yes, apparently he was also prepared to jeopardize his own existence because he must have known, having lived around Esau ever since his birth, he must have known that Esau would have been furious with him and might even try to kill him, as we read later. Rebecca overhears that Esau has intentions of killing Jacob because Jacob has gotten the blessing. Dr. Ginsburg.
Mr. Gold, may I interject a question here which concerns me and I'm sure would concern our listeners. We talk about the birthright. I wonder if someone would explain to us really what Scripture means when it talks of birthright.
Well, we tried, in a sense. A birthright, I think, will involve certain privileges. As Dr. Halkin said before, you've got the privilege of a double portion. You've got the privilege also, I think, of leadership. You succeed the former leader if you have the birthright. I think from the story that we have here, revolving around Esau and Jacob, you evidently see that if you have the birthright, you get the blessing. And one of the most fascinating things through the stories of Genesis in particular is to watch how everybody struggles very, very hard to get the blessing. Later, Jacob has a number of sons, 12 sons. Notice that of all his sons, Joseph is his favorite. Again, there is resentment on the part of the brothers towards Joseph because Joseph is evidently the one who's going to inherit the blessing. Blessing, as Thomas Mann has very acutely seen in writing up this story, plays a very important part in all the narratives that we get here. Now, Esau throwing that up is what amazes everybody. He is supposed to be the vigorous one. He is supposed to be the man who is not so retiring. And the interesting thing is that he comes in from the field worn out, tired, and apparently so exhausted that he will not even use any energy to feed himself. And immediately he sells that birthright. No wonder he later feels that he's given up something and he resents it. Dr. Halkin.
Well, it's as Dr. Ginsburg pointed out before. It was a step taken without too much thinking But he regretted it further, later on. He realized that he lost a great deal and, of course, couldn't reclaim it then. And consequently, the only recourse he had was in his attempts to take vengeance.
Dr. Ginsberg.
I'm impressed with another aspect of this matter. Ordinarily, we look on the quality of leadership as a greatly prized quality. Actually, the responsibility of leadership is very oppressive and very difficult. And I wonder how much of Esau's ease in selling this was not only that he was, to use clinical language, depressed, but that the responsibility of leadership, which he saw promised to him, also was a bit of a threat, and he was eager and anxious to, especially when he was defeated and had experienced a failure, to shift that responsibility of leadership and to get rid of it.
Mr. Kitchen.
Well, it seems to me that is the point I was trying to bring out before, that actually the responsibility seems the type that Esau is not willing to undertake. I think that there are many people, there are many nations who take that point of view today. I was rather struck a little earlier when you were speaking about the two sons struggling for the prestige and the responsibility, that we often have that situation among nations. We have it among particular groups, for instance, political factions, labor groups, and so on within the country. And that the assumption of responsibility is sometimes rather hard won, and after it is won, it is not always well used for a time. I think particularly, for instance, the United States and the USSR have both emerged on the international scene somewhat contemporaneously as great powers. That is, both of them seized what they thought was a birthright. And I think that both of us can be accused of having used it less than wisely at times. That is, we didn't have the vision to see the full possibilities. I think that this is partly a thing that they had to learn. As I recall, Jacob had to learn it a little later.
Would we be fair in saying this? I don't want to read too much into this biblical story. I think that's one of the great dangers that we always face. We read a biblical story, and yet I think we do more reading into it than we do reading of it. But this is the question I'd like to throw out. Would we be fair in saying that what Esau wants, as is evident by the development of the story later, is the privileges of birthright? He'd like to have the blessing that the father gives. He'd like to be able to inherit the father's position. But that he is not, as is evident in this story, ready to assume the responsibilities of the birthright. Dr. Halkin.
I don't know how fair it would be to analyze it this way on the basis of the biblical account, but certainly later tradition is strictly in agreement with the suggestion made by Mr. Golden. Later tradition describes Esau as a man who is interested in the immediate goods, worldly goods, and has no higher aspirations or any nobler ideals. Whereas Jacob, on the other hand, is the person who is very much interested in the good of all and in the pursuit of some of the noble ideas of this world.
Mr. Kitchen.
Would it be fair to say, too, that Jacob was willing to make sacrifices afterwards in order to realize these, and that probably Esau would not have been.
Dr. Ginsberg.
Isn't it part of the legend that Esau gets the possessions of the world, the worldly thing, and Jacob is rewarded in the things of the world to come, the more spiritual things? Am I right in that?
Yes, that is, of course, how the later rabbinic tradition likes to take this story. Indeed, there is a wonderful play on words here, which is evident in the Hebrew, but can't be too well conveyed in the English. You know, the word for birthright is bechorah. And the word for blessing is baracha. If you just put those two words together, bechora, baracha. And the rabbis point out that Esau said, I don't want the bechora, I don't want the birthright, but I sure would like to have the baracha. I'd like to have the blessing.
Very human failing.
A very human failing, and a human failing, incidentally, acutely observed later by the narrator in Genesis, because when Jacob gets the blessing, Esau cries out, why, Jacob has deceived me twice. And in actuality, Jacob had not deceived him in this particular account. He has sold it to him. And Esau is then, you see, only thinking not of what he did, but he's thinking in terms of the blessing.
Incidentally, I don't want to hop on this introvert-extrovert too much, but that would fit in also with the common modern conception. The introverts of the world are the people who value books and learning and education. And the, by and large, the extroverts are those who value more highly the real material things. I don't think one is more evil than the other. They're just different, one from the other.
Well, I think it is true to say that we've got here two different types. There is no question. One, whether we'll call him introverted or not, is certainly not this vigorous outdoor man that Esau is.
The meat eater.
The meat eater. Very, very good. I don't know what the diet of Jacob was, frankly, but apparently he was definitely an indoor person. And if we want to take the hint of the rabbinic tradition, I don't think we would be altogether unfair in doing so. Namely, the man sitting indoors would be the man who is the student. Moreover, he would be the man who would be prepared to forego an immediate pleasure for a larger, later possible gain. Mr. Kitchen.
Well, he has the vision that it seems to me we're trying to instill into modern democracy. That is to see the responsibility, the possibilities.
Mr. Halkin.
In all this discussion, I think we've overlooked one rather important item that in the earlier verses in the story, it is made quite clear that Esau and Jacob are more than just two individuals. They represent two people.
Very good. That's actually how the text goes. Would you amplify on that?
Yes, what I should really like to add is that according to the biblical story, because the birthright was purchased by Jacob, and because the blessing fell to him, then he really should have been the stronger of the two nations. As a matter of fact, however, the contrary happened, and later tradition has a great deal to say about how it is that Esau, who is supposed to be Rome in imperial times, is the leading power rather than Israel.
The birthright, it would seem to me, as I think back over the whole story and even over our discussion, the birthright, it would seem to me, is made up of two parts. There is no doubt that the birthright will involve certain privileges. There is similarly no doubt that the birthright is going to involve a number of burdens. One of the burdens evidently is going to be that Jacob is going to have to leave home and live among strangers. What almost justifies the biblical decision, it seems to me, is Esau's readiness to throw it off and Jacob's readiness to take it on.
You've just heard another in the Eternal Light Summer Series, The Words We Live By. Our moderator was Professor Judah Golden, and our panelists were Dr. Saul Ginsberg and Professor Abraham Halkin. Our special guest today was Professor Joseph Kitchen of the Government Department of Queens College. Be with us again next week when we'll present a special Tisha B'Av program. Comments from the listeners will be appreciated. Our guest next week will be Cantor Robert Siegel and the Distinguished Consulate General of Israel in New York, the Honorable Arthur Lurie. Free time to present The Words We Live By is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America.
Tonight's the night for another full hour summer concert by the NBC Symphony Orchestra. Yes, at 8:30 this evening, be sure to be on hand when special guests Lawrence Melchior and conductor Max Reiter join the NBC Symphony for another outstanding program. The preceding program was transcribed. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.